Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast in which we discuss the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films of all time. Before you go any further, be warned. What you're about to hear is riddled with spoilers. We suggest you watch the movie before listening to this podcast.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
So it's Bev and Ryan and Fox with the 20th movie in the Top 100 Project, and it is Wuthering Heights. 'Twas 73rd on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list, between Ben-Hur and The Gold Rush, but was the 7th of the 20 films we've watched so far that missed the cut in 2007. Wuthering Heights premiered on March 24th, 1939, then United Artists officially released it on April 7th. The film was not a big hit. It took a few re-releases to get in the black. Although it's based on Emily Bronte's book, Wuthering Heights isn't exactly the world's most discussed movie, so here's Bev with the skinny.
Peasant class and gypsy Heathcliff, played by Laurence Olivier, grows up with the wealthy Earnshaw family, falling in love with the haughty Kathy, played by Merle Oberon, and feuding with her brother Hindley. Heathcliff and Kathy are lifelong star-crossed lovers in this tale of class struggle, prejudice, and tragic romantic longing.
Or if I may nutshell this one, Bev, it's Titanic without the boat. Or the iceberg.
That's so funny that you say that, because I have been thinking about Titanic ever since we saw this movie.
That's why I stole it for my nutshell. Because you did say that.
Both very melodramatic. Class struggle romances. Mm-hmm. Also melodramatic.
Well, okay, well then. I take it you didn't like Titanic very much. Did you like this one?
Not really.
Yeah.
It is not for me. Some people, this is their thing. This is their jam. They love the melodrama. It's just never, I've never loved it. There was parts that definitely I started to get into and get engaged with, but I just...
When did you check out?
Well, the whole beginning, I really struggled to get into it. And then I started to enjoy it when the kids had grown up and Heathcliff comes back. And there was all this drama with the sister-in-law and it started to get really juicy. But then I checked out again. Once she's dying, she's just awful.
She was dying of a broken heart.
Oh, her character is so unlikable.
I'm glad you
agree. Both of them are. Both of them are. I don't want either of them to have what they want. Because you've got Heathcliff who is, when he's older, he's so consumed with this need for revenge that he's just this black heart. There doesn't seem to be anything good coming out of his behavior. And he'll ruin Isabel's life and he'll try and steal this man's wife. He doesn't care. He's just so driven.
You don't think that he's doing it for love? You think he's doing it for revenge?
Buying Hindley out is for revenge, strictly.
He kind of owed Hindley a little bit.
That guy
him like crap his whole life.
Hindley certainly earned that one. Why would he marry Isabel?
That was definitely out of spite.
Yeah, that was just out of spite. And then you have Kathy, who is... She's like bipolar. She loves Heathcliff. She loves Edgar. And of course, she doesn't really love Edgar.
She loves his money.
She loves his money, which makes her unlikable. It's not a very appealing character. And this spoils a lot of old movies for me. A lot of people really praise the acting in this movie, but come on. It was such overkill. It was just hard to watch, and it was so phony at times, and such overkill that I had a hard time even discerning what the characters were feeling. Like, in that death scene when Kathy's dying, I'm sure she's supposed to be expressing any number of things like love and regret and passion, but it just looks like she's trying to wordlessly warn Heathcliff that there's like a giant spider descending from the ceiling or something. Her eyes are bugging out of her head. She's clawing at him. I don't know how that's supposed to express anything. You know, I read some of the old reviews and they really heavily praise these performances. I don't agree.
Did you like his performance?
Not really.
You didn't know who Olivier was from experience going into this movie. You don't think you've seen a movie of his. We'll get one more in 1960 with Spartacus. He's not even the star of that movie, but he didn't have a lot of AFI films. He's more of an English filmmaker. He did Hamlet about 9 years after this, which won him awards. But it's an English film, so it couldn't have been nominated for the AFI in the first place. Olivier was a great actor. He was also a bit of a ham.
He was a theater actor.
He was a theater actor, yeah. He was newish to movies. I think he was still straddling the two things and leaning more towards the stage.
I'm sure that for the time, they were good actors, but to me, it's just this glaring example of how desperately film needed this Strasberg method and, like, something to revolutionize the art of acting to kind of usher in realistic film acting.
That's true. We're still a long way away from those kinds of performances, but overall, the star performances are going to get better as we go along now, I think, I hope. We're also seeing plenty of movies in the next few months that I haven't seen more than once. Gone with the Wind is a great example of that, and it's also similar in some ways to this. It's also a melodrama. It's also based on the unrequited love of two people. So we'll see when we get there what we think of that movie. As I've said, it's been a long time since I've seen it, and you never have. But Wuthering Heights is one of the few romantic melodramas that is anything close to this histrionic on this list. As I said, Gone with the Wind has those kinds of moments, and you'll see soon enough. But I don't know, there are many others that really qualify quite this way. Titanic does it in some ways too, but there you go. We compared them off the top.
Yep.
DiCaprio and Winslet do the best they can with James Cameron's debatably acceptable dialogue.
Yes.
They do a good job with that dialogue, really, and they're both pretty damn good.
I'm sure I can say with confidence I prefer their performances. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a better movie overall, but I definitely prefer their performances as Rose and Jack. And maybe in order to have a romantic melodrama work, there has to be, like, more likability. But even as I say that, this is an exceptionally popular movie. A lot of people disagree with me. They will disagree about their performances, and they'll disagree about the character's likability, and that's fine. At least they have complexity, and there's something to be said for that. It just really didn't work for me.
Well, as far as this movie being popular with critics and audiences and AFI and such, it didn't make the second AFI list, as I said a little while ago. And again, another example of a movie that was fairly well ranked, 73rd to Zippo the next time out.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to see where the films that got knocked off, the 23 that got knocked off, where they finished. Did Wuthering Heights finish 173rd? Was it 220th? Yeah. Or was it 101st?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Curious to know that. Getting back to Kathy. Now, she's the villain of this movie, if there has to be any kind of villain. Her brother's a jerk through the whole thing, but he's kind of an alcoholic loser in the last, really the last half of the movie. He's a non-factor completely at that point, and he loses his own home to this boy slash man he hated all of his youth. But Kathy, she's bipolar, might be a fair estimation of what she is.
The way she behaves during those scenes when she's trying to decide between Heathcliff and Edgar, she turns on a dime. It's dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
How quickly a pretty dress turns her head.
Yeah. Well, she's pretty shallow. She keeps resisting Heathcliff's love, even though he tries more than once through the years to tell her he's absolutely crazy about her, and she's supposedly crazy about him. She only finally accepts him when she's on her deathbed.
Yeah.
Oh, come to me, Heathcliff. Well, too late now. Even though Heathcliff says she should do it, what right does this snob have to haunt him as a ghost? She's worse than the crazy Japanese ghost in The Grudge. At least that chick had a reason to be angry and haunt people.
This girl just wants to have her cake and eat it too. So apparently in the book, the ending is quite dramatically different.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that too.
Yeah, she apparently while they're living, their relationship gets quite a bit less amicable. And they have children in the book. When she haunts Heathcliff, it is her ghost, not her ghost trying to like woo him to spend eternity with her. It's her ghost trying to stop him from getting her daughter's inheritance. Like she wants her daughter to inherit Wuthering Heights, so she lures him to his death.
Which isn't her family's home anymore.
Yeah. And another way that Kathy's a jerk. Apparently, like, several people, several of the creative people involved in the film really fought the way that the ending was in that very last shot of the two ghosts going out to the crag.
Right. The story is that Samuel Goldwyn, who produced the movie, he's the G of MGM.
Mm-hmm.
Although he was fired before he ever even took part in the company. But he produced the movie. And he felt this was his best production ever. And he's the one that came up with the idea of having their ghosts wander off into, that they're together now. And that wasn't even the two actors. They were gone from the production by this point. It was shot so late, so they just used doubles. It's such a brief little
shot. Which in a way is similar to the very last thing you see in Titanic, which is Rose's ghost meeting Jack's ghost in heaven. As she dies, of course, a very old woman, but she still meets Jack in heaven, along with all the other passengers on the Titanic.
Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major problems I had with the movie was the ending where the maid describes what Heathcliff does. He runs off into the moors and at the end he's going after Kathy's ghost and he dies, I guess, of a broken heart or something. And she describes it all to us. What a bad example of don't show us, but tell us. I mean, I don't want to hear you describe this. Show it. It might have been a poetic way to do it. We didn't like the movie much, but it might have been a very beautiful couple minutes of film.
I know. One of the, what became of one of the stars of the movie. He's dead.
See ya, Larry.
Credits roll. And then he died. The end.
It would have been nice if we could have seen that rather than be told that's what happened.
Yeah, that's
what
is a good point.
What are they doing, a podcast?
Wah, 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 wah.
So anyway, Goldwyn wanted to do this ending, and he obviously did do this ending, and he was a very powerful producer, without a doubt. But the director, William Wyler, had no interest, and he thought it was a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
But Goldwyn overruled him, as any producer could, certainly back in those days. Goldwyn famously said that he made Wuthering Heights. Wyler only directed it. What a strange thing these days. You'd never hear somebody, if they said that these days,
it would be pretty controversial.
It would be very controversial.
Yeah, then it's fighting words.
And did you notice, I think I pointed it out at the time, that Goldwyn got last billing over Wyler. It was directed by William Wyler, and then it said produced by Samuel Goldwyn.
If I've ever seen that before, I've never noticed. Like, that's pretty bold.
The Directors Guild would forbid that today.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of problems with the way the guilds work, with the writers, directors, producers, and such. Even if you were all three of those things, writer, director, producer, it has to be worded in such a way. The director always has to come last.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can't have,
specific.
I think you can't have producer between writer and director or something like that.
Yeah, I've worked on feature films, and it goes as far as the ratio of how long somebody's name is on screen. Like, you have to be very specific about this. You can't be too short with some, you can't be too long with others.
Well, we're into William Wyler here, so let's keep talking about him. This is his first AFI movie. There's three in total, Best Years of Our Lives and Ben-Hur yet to come. Wyler, here's an interesting little tidbit about Wyler. He directed the most actors to Oscar nominations of any director in history, with 31 different people honored with at least one nomination, and 13 times his actors won.
Wow.
Scorsese has, I think, 5 actors that have won awards for him, and Spielberg didn't have any. Steven Spielberg had none until this past year with Lincoln, first time that an actor had ever won an award for him. But there you go, Wyler had 13 people do that. Now, he was a notorious Kubrick-esque perfectionist. What I say earlier about Olivia having one other film on the list, Kubrick directed it.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And that would be Spartacus. But anyway, Wyler required dozens of takes, and that drove Olivier crazy during the production. Although Olivier did say nice things about Wyler in his book many years later. And he mentioned how Wyler taught him how to play to a movie camera, not to the back row.
I guess that's a hard thing to get used to when you're coming from the theater, to do multiple takes over and over again of the same scene.
Mm-hmm. And Wyler and Kubrick both had the same sort of thing where they're essentially wearing the actors down. It wasn't like they were giving them direction as to, so what am I doing wrong? No, just do it again. And then do it again. Some actors thrive in that, others don't.
What's the notorious fight that they had on set? I think it was for Wuthering Heights, Wyler and Olivier. It was, I've done it from behind. Mm-hmm. I've done it sitting down. I've done it
scratching my ear.
Yeah, I've done it scratching my ear.
Done it with a camera shooting my back.
And how many ways do you want me to do it? I want you to do it better.
Yeah. I want to say a little bit more about some of the people behind the screen, because there's some very famous names involved with the screenplay, adapting Bronte's classic book, which I've not read. But one of the writers was John Huston. I don't know if he had a big hand on the screenplay, but John Huston, who we're going to see quite a bit of in the 40s, and he's kind of sprinkled throughout the AFI list, actually, but he does have a film coming up in a couple of months, The Maltese Falcon.
That he wrote?
Wrote and directed.
Oh, he wrote and directed.
That was his big debut. Ben Hecht was also a writer on this one. He had a hand in 3 AFI screenplays, all in 1939.
Wow.
And he also had credits on non-AFI classics like His Girl Friday, Gunga Din, Notorious, and the original Scarface.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy to talk about for behind the scenes is Greg Tolan with the cinematography. Need we say more?
Well, he was the cinematographer on Citizen Kane.
Yeah, Tolan would go on to work with Orson Welles on Kane, and also 2 other AFIers, The Grapes of Wrath and Best Years of Our Lives with Wyler. So he worked with Ford, he worked with Welles, he worked with Wyler on 4 different AFI films, and we're seeing all of them within the next couple of months, really.
Yeah. And I will throw this movie a bone. I know all I've done is kind of criticize it, but the cinematography was really striking.
It earned its award.
Oh my gosh, and it did another thing a Stagecoach did with the low ceilings and in Wuthering Heights in the home. Mm. The way that those shots were set up, it actually reminded me a little bit of Sunrise, which is another very melodramatic movie, in that there were so many shots that if you just took them alone, they could have been a beautiful photograph. It was really, really lovely to watch. And the shots were really rich with meaning as well. So I will give it credit for that. The mise-en-scene, the cinematography, and the set design as well. Those were all, like, absolutely exceptional. Genius.
Yes. All right, let's get back to the big stars, Olivier and Oberon. Olivier, for all of his fame and relative fortune and success and everything, he was the 14th best male actor on the top 100 stars list. This is the first time I've ever mentioned that on one of these podcasts, but there it is. He was behind the likes of Fred Astaire and John Wayne, but he was not even in the top 10, which surprised me. I hadn't looked at that list in quite a few years until I did a few days ago, and I thought he would be higher than 14.
Who's number one?
Bogart.
Bogart.
Yeah, not the greatest actor of all time, but that's who they picked. Huh. I think Hepburn, Catherine Hepburn, was number one on the actresses list. Olivier went on to direct 5 of his own movies, mostly adaptations of Shakespeare. I mentioned Hamlet and Henry V.
As a director, he was portrayed by Kenneth Branagh in My Week with Marilyn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they were doing The Prince and the Showgirl, which he also directed.
How many films have we seen in this list where the directors have been portrayed by somebody very famous in films?
Many years later, yeah. Yeah. And sometimes in really lauded performances.
Yes, yeah.
Robert Downey Jr. playing Chaplin. Yeah. And McKellen playing Whale so well in Gods and Monsters.
These are people that still like captivated in people's imagination and were worthy of making feature films about.
And Hitchcock, who will come up not for a while yet in the project, but he's been portrayed by many people in the last couple of years alone.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to Olivier. Now, he was also in Rebecca the following year, 1940, which has a similar story to this, and he's got a similar role even, although I think he's better in Wuthering Heights than he is in Rebecca. I'm not a big fan of Rebecca. Funny enough, I own Rebecca. We own Rebecca on DVD. I keep saying I, but I don't own Wuthering Heights, and if I had to choose, I probably would go with Wuthering Heights. I don't think it's an AFI film. I didn't say this off the top. I don't think it's AFI worthy any more than you do. I think I like it slightly more than you do. But Rebecca's not something I like as much as I used to.
I think I was just disappointed by it. The day before we watched it, we were in the company of one of my sister's friends, and when we told her we were about to see this movie, she just about swooned about how much she loved it, and then it got my hopes up, I think.
We should not tell Lauren what we thought of this film. She cannot listen to this podcast. If you're listening, Lauren, you've come too far. Turn back!
I'll defend my thoughts in person, Lauren, I promise.
Now, as for Oberon, his lovely co-star, she was actually billed above Olivier. 2 movies in a row now where the by far bigger legend, as the years have gone on, John Wayne in Stagecoach, Olivier in this, had second billing to their female co-stars. Claire Trevor was Stagecoach, mm-hmm. and now Oberon.
They were bigger stars at the time.
And that's exactly why. This is Oberon's only AFI film. Maybe that's for the best.
Well, she is extremely skilled at throwing her face into her elbow to mimic crying, because that's how humans cry, apparently.
I often cry that way, especially when watching Merle Oberon. She wasn't fond of Olivier, and he didn't like her much either, and they had problems with Wyler as well. They all seemed to be feuding mm-hmm. on the set, but the movie came off well enough, so I guess in the end, it's one of those movies where, you know, you hear a cut and then instantly, okay, get away from me. It's not one of those movies where they're off having some fun between takes. Well, maybe they did. What do we know? And Oberon wasn't even thrilled to be working with David Niven because they had been real-life lovers years before.
Oh, really?
So she was a pain in many ways on this film. But Niven plays her husband. We haven't talked much about him. He's one of the supporting cast members, David Niven. Donald Crisp is another one. He was in Mutiny on the Bounty, if you recall. Mm-hmm. And he's in this film. And Geraldine Fitzgerald, who played Isabella. Niven's one of the more, I don't know, I guess you could say more talented / famous second bananas we've had on the project so far.
He's kind of forgettable in this one.
He's got Geraldine Fitzgerald. Boring.
She stood out more to me. She, like, her performance I liked better.
Now, we've been saying that people in this movie are extremely selfish, and that becomes even more clear after Isabella says, "If Kathy died, I might begin to live."
I know.
Maybe you can't blame her. That's pretty terrible.
She feels at least some remorse as she's speaking the words. and because it's probably true as well. She's living in the shadow of this woman.
And knows it. Well, knows it all along. Marries him knowing all of that. It is a story of snobbery and class warfare.
With the exception of the scenes that stand out quite nicely when they run off to Penistone Crag, their castle, and then their lovers without the constructs of society to hold them back.
Well, that brings us to our sponsor for this week. Hey, Top 100 fans, have you ever longed for a romantic hookup spot where you can declare your love and then spend the rest of your life not following through? Well, look no further than Penistone Crag. It's Inspiration Point without the sex. Lock your lady in a clinch, but don't be surprised if she marries someone else. If she does, all you need to do is marry someone else yourself out of pure spite. Penistone Crag, the perfect place for broken hearts and failed dreams.
Revenge on Clint. I have a theory about the popularity of this movie. I think that the reason people like this movie and people like movies like this is that it just contains this real element of fantasy fulfillment. say you're a woman watching this movie, is that desirability fantasy that she should be so lovable, that two men are fighting over her, and that one of those men is driven absolutely mad by his love for her, and there is something kind of, there's a fantasy fulfillment in that. And then with men, it's obvious, it's the revenge fantasy. I think, like, any man who feels like there's an inadequacy to their means would love watching this movie and seeing this guy totally get revenge on all those rich jerks that made his life miserable. And he shows them all, you know? So there's that. And there's the fantasy fulfillment of it being a film that came right around the Great Depression. And, of course, it really does not come across favorable to the wealthy, particularly those born into wealth. And they all come across as shallow and selfish and possibly bipolar. And Kathy's big mistake, of course, was choosing wealth over love. And even though, of course, it's mostly implied that it's a mistake because Heathcliff went off and became wealthy, and if she had just been patient, she would have had everything. But her fatal flaw was greed.
Agreed. We didn't like her. If we haven't made that clear enough yet, we're making it clear now.
Yeah, I didn't really like either of them, but she was particularly hard to stomach.
Okay, so the influence of Wuthering Heights. So it's a melodramatic love story about star-crossed lovers. We've made that very clear. But was this the movie that set a tone for those kinds of films that followed? I don't know if that's really true. I mean, you mentioned Sunrise. I'd forgotten Sunrise when we talked about the melodramas, the melodramatic love stories.
Very similar in tone, at least.
Mm, that's true. Wuthering Heights has been remade many times, though. And let's just take a look at how often. It's a lot of them more recently. You've got Juliette Binoche and Ralph Fiennes in 1992's version of it. You've got a 98 version with actors I don't recognize their names. You've got 2003 with two more actors I don't really recognize their names. 2009 with Tom Hardy and Charlotte Riley. And 2011 with actors, again, where I don't recognize their names. But there you go. It's a lot of remakes.
That could be a testament to the popularity of the novel as well. I think a lot of people really do like the book.
I wonder if the other adaptations of Wuthering Heights have cut out 18 chapters as this one did.
Yeah, that's right. The 1939 film only covers maybe half of the book.
Because it cuts out the parts about their children. Yeah,
there's a whole like second generation part that goes on afterwards.
Goldwyn was a monster.
Whatever. I'm glad I only had to sit through about 2 hours of this.
That's probably enough. And as we come close to wrapping it up, we will, as always, talk about the awards and other AFI lists. It was 15th on the top 100 passions. Now, like the movie or not, that's probably appropriate. It's a movie filled with passion. And as we said, it won the Best Cinematography Oscar for Greg Toland. And Wuthering Heights was put on the National Film Registry in 2007. I'm sure you don't agree with that one.
Well, at least it didn't get on until 2007. Maybe they were running out of titles.
What are we going to preserve this year? We have to preserve something.
All this space.
We don't lose our funding. Oh, throw a dart at the board. Well, Wuthering Heights, okay, fine. What's it about? Who cares?
Who cares?
Okay, we're being too hard on it now.
Woman who likes to throw her face into the inside of her elbow a lot.
So,
and cry, Heathcliff. Oh, Heathcliff.
Oh, Kathy.
Oh, remember that time in the crag? Heathcliff, we were so happy, Heathcliff.
We were.
Sorry.
So, obviously, when we talk, as we often do at the end, of whether or not a film deserves to be on the list at all, we're saying no for Wuthering Heights. I think that's pretty much end of story with that.
Well, you don't speak for me. No, I agree.
You agree more than I do on that one.
Yeah, I did not love this movie. It has some virtues, certainly. And many people disagree with us. It has a 100% Rotten Tomatoes.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Good God.
I know. Come on. I guess I wouldn't tell somebody not to. Oh, actually, I might tell somebody not to watch this movie. This is like the kind of movie that has always put me off classic films when I was younger. Part of the reason why I've never seen most of these movies is because I imagine them all to be just like Wuthering Heights with the hammy acting and the overkill. Yeah.
Well, okay. That's it for Wuthering Heights. But there's another W in our very near future. And it's next on the Top 100 Project. It's an obscure title. The Wizard of Oz!
Mm-hmm.
But before we get to that, we're going to take a week off from the Top 100 Project to bring you something a little different. It's the debut of the Not 100 Project, in which we'll periodically review a movie that didn't make either of AFI's Top 100 lists, but we think it should have. Or we just like the movie in question so much that we just feel like talking about it. Our first Not 100 will be, wait for it, Bruce Willis as John McClane in the action classic Die Hard. And we've got many other very popular and very famous titles in the months and months ahead. We're going to do that, as I said, periodically. We'll let you know when those are upcoming. So look for that next week.
In the meantime, for more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, or you can find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter, @top100project.
Oh, Heathcliff and Kathy, we will miss you so much.
Oh, Heathcliff.
Oh, Kathy.
And cut.